suspected of organizing some of the variant and collaborator activities. Beyond that, they didn't know much about this new mission. A distant pop, like the sound of gunfire, rattled somewhere far from the command building. Dohai tensed, waiting for the chorus of gunfire and variant shrieks to erupt in response. Beside him, Mendez and Rico both readied their suppressed M4A1s.
"Maybe just another straggler," Fitz said.
Ace lowered his shotgun and tightened the strap on the M4A1 slung over his back.
"All this waiting has me on edge, man, and I need to take a damn shit."
"Makes two of us," Mendez said.
He smirked. "I mean, on edge. Took care of my business earlier, old man." The team turned as soldiers rushed out of command between the razor wire and fences surrounding the building. Some lugged heavy machine guns into new positions. Others carried ammo cans and crates of supplies to defensive positions. The patter of boots against pavement drilled the ground around them like a rainstorm.
"Better clench your cheeks," Mendez told Ace. "Shit's about to go down."
"Ghost!"
a voice called over the tarmac. Lieutenant Mark Forster jogged toward them, a glowing tablet cradled in one arm. Two men flanked the officer.
"The Osprey is en route. ETA 10 minutes,
Forster said. He was out of breath, and Dohai didn't think it was because of the run.
"The variants are beginning their assault, mostly concentrated around the target cities," Forster added. "Most aircraft were diverted to evac missions."
Dohai thought of all the innocents in harm's way, and the man he had put out of his misery. The image wouldn't leave his mind.
"Three additional teams are already on their way to other mastermind locations," the lieutenant continued. "With any luck, their success and yours will disrupt the variant's communication networks enough to hold back the hordes so more people can reach safety."
The staccato burst of automatic weapons filled the night. Forster turned toward the direction of the gunfire. Once again, it settled without resulting in wailing alarms announcing a true attack. Forster held out his tablet.
"Gather around. We've got a lot to cover and not a lot of time to do it."
The screen showed an aerial view of New Orleans. Most of the city looked flooded, each block and building its own island in a sea of muck-strewn water. At the center of the image was a large white dome, its roof fractured and missing in places.
"Earlier today, one of our drones captured an image of the mastermind in the French Quarter of the city."
He showed the screen to the members of Team Ghost in turn. They all knew what they were looking at from their experience in Minneapolis. Huge folds of tissue hung from a monstrosity with a face that looked like it had been melted in a nuclear explosion. Long tendrils of red webbing stretched from its flesh as it navigated between ruined hotels and restaurants.
"Why the hell didn't you destroy it already?" Dohai asked.
"We tried, but the damn things are faster than they look," Forster replied. "Still, we have reason to believe it isn't far from the French Quarter. That's why we're sending you."
"We'll burn this bastard to a crisp, sir," Mendez said.
Rico nodded while chewing her gum. Forster's radio buzzed, and a voice came in clear after a burst of static. He pressed it to his ear to hear above the din of soldiers preparing the base for attack.
"Osprey's on its descent," he reported.
Dohai scanned the night, looking for a glimpse of the aircraft in the moon-soaked sky. He heard the roar of the craft's engines before he saw it. As soon as he began to point the Osprey out to the rest of the team, another chorus of gunfire blazed from a pair of machine gun nests and a guard tower not more than a mile north of their position. This time the gunfire settled into a constant flurry. Spotlights lanced through the darkness, illuminating wide swaths of the base outside the defensive barriers. Forster stared for a beat, and in that moment, Dohai almost felt bad for the man. In a few minutes, the terror from the night before would commence again. The two soldiers accompanying Forster aimed their rifles toward the sounds of war, and the lieutenant drew his Sig Sauer M17.
"Form a defensive perimeter around the LZ," he ordered. "Keep this area clear until Team Ghost is away."
One of the two loadmasters trembled near the stack of ammo cans. He looked over at the Delta Force operators, his lip quivering at the sound of the advancing monsters. Dohai shared that fear, though he worked to suppress it. He couldn't help but think of a quote that his father had told him. "A brave man dies but once, a coward many times."
"Look out!"
a voice cried from one of the barricades. A rocket streamed from somewhere beyond the fence. It slammed into one of the guard towers. A soldier flew backward from the tower, his limbs separating from his torso. Another fell out, fire coursing over his body.
"Collaborators!" Ace yelled.
More howls and screams erupted between the waves of gunfire. The ground rumbled beneath their feet. One of the ammo cans fell from the stack, clinking to the tarmac with a metallic ring. A loadmaster bent to recover it. Behind him, a hole appeared in the ground, asphalt and dirt giving away. An alpha clawed itself up, its bat-like ears twitching, nostrils flaring, body covered in soil. The monster let out a roar, followed by rapid clicking.
"Open fire!" Fitz yelled.
Rounds lanced into the alpha's flesh. It let out a screech as it dragged itself toward the loadmaster, blood spraying out of the bullet holes. Despite the storm of gunfire, it lifted a claw into the air, ready to slash down across the loadmaster's chest. Dohai aimed for the creature's face and fired a burst, shattering bone. Blood gurgled out of the beast's nostrils and mouth, and it finally collapsed.
"Osprey incoming!" Forster yelled. "Ghost, get ready!"
The aircraft came into view, lights glowing from the fuselage. It made a vertical descent toward them, the rear ramp already opening to allow a quick getaway. Smaller beasts began climbing from the hole the Alpha had broken through. Their joints clicked, and their teeth gnashed together. Everything blurred around Dohai as Team Ghost sent a fusillade of rounds tearing into their ranks. This was not the only hole that had opened up behind the defensive lines. Others appeared across the airfield, swallowing asphalt and even people rushing to new positions. Alphas emerged from the earthen craters, shaking off dirt from the long tendrils snaking over their bodies. Legions of armed juvenile variants followed behind them. A loud thump sounded as the Osprey's wheels touched down.
"Good luck, Ghost! Kill that motherfucker for all of us!" Forster roared.
The loadmasters and Ghost rushed onto the aircraft, carrying their supplies. A pair of crew chiefs helped throw the ammo cans onto the deck. The activity attracted the variants like bugs to a light. Even with the gunfire resounding from other units scattered around the airfield, the beasts were almost within striking distance. Forster fired his M-17 into two of the monsters that came bounding on all fours. His guards continued to flank him, their rifles blazing to keep the monsters at bay and buy Ghost time. One of the loadmasters ran back to the stack of supplies for another crate. Before he made it, a lunging variant tackled him and sunk its claws between his ribs. Dohai killed the beast, firing from within the Osprey, but the damage was done. The loadmaster took a final breath before going limp. The other man hefted on a final ammo can. As soon as he did, a variant wrapped its claws around him, pulling him backward.
"No!"
Dohai yelled. He tried to get a shot, but it was too late. The beast sunk its teeth into the man's neck and ripped out a chunk of flesh and artery. Blood sprayed across the interior of the Osprey. The aircraft lifted off as a swarm of the beasts consumed the dying loadmasters while Forster and his men retreated. Team Ghost continued to fire at the advancing beasts from the troop hold next to a crew chief on a mounted M240. Creatures threw themselves at the tilt-rotor craft, raking their claws along the outside. Dohai trained his fire on the diseased beasts now surrounding the lieutenant and his two soldiers. One of the men went to change his magazine and was shredded by a pair of deadly claws. Forster and the other two men disappeared under a wave of gray flesh. Dohai choked out a breath, watching again from the sky while men died below. Once again, there was nothing he could do to save them. He couldn't even end their misery with a bullet. Fitz bowed his head, and Rico put a hand on his shoulder as they retreated into the Osprey with Ace. Mendez remained at the rear lift gate with the crew chief, raining fire into the hordes. Dohai brought his rifle back up with a new magazine and joined them. He fired where he had last seen the three brave soldiers that had given their lives for Team Ghost.
"Incoming!" one of the pilots yelled.
Dohai spotted the cloud of smoke from a launched Law rocket. With a lurch, the craft suddenly decelerated hard and then descended just enough for the rocket to careen overhead. The rear ramp was almost closed as the pilot started to pull them back into the sky. But now they were within an arm's distance of the monsters again. A juvenile leapt and thrust itself through the gap between the rear ramp and the fuselage. It bristled with claws and flesh covered in tough armor. Slotted yellow eyes fixed on the crew chief as it let loose a screech and slammed into the man. Wild gunfire in a space like this was far too risky, but Dohai refused to let another man die for them tonight. He drew his hatchet and slammed it into the armored skull. The monster crashed against the bulkhead. Dohai ripped the blade out and brought it down again. Bones split, flesh peeled, and blood poured from the gaping skull wounds. It still managed to snap at him, and he brought the hatchet down again and again until he had opened up a red canyon in the skull. Brain matter sloshed out over the deck.
"Ace, Rico, help him," Fitz said.
The duo began tending to the crew chief's lacerations. The man writhed on the deck. None of his wounds appeared fatal, but he was definitely hurting. All things considered, he was lucky to be alive. Team Ghost was just as lucky. Dohai stepped back to a window for a view of command. The base had quickly transformed into a war zone, leaving the soldiers in the path of the monsters. Through a window, Dohai saw the flicker of dozens of rifles around command. One by one, the glimmer of muzzle flashes disappeared. A few sparks of gunfire cut out from a final guard tower, but it too vanished in a bright explosion from a law rocket. The resulting fireball illuminated a landscape covered in crumpled bodies. Variants stormed the base, skittering up the main building and consuming the final defenses like an angry colony of ants. Dohai tried to comfort himself with more words from his grandfather, passed on from a tribe in the Pacific Northwest. There is no death, only a change of worlds. But from what Dohai had seen in the tunnels, from what he had seen down here, he could not find solace in those souls changing worlds when the transition looked so terrifyingly horrible. Accompanied by the collaborators, the horde of monsters had easily overrun the final defenses of the base and consumed the command building.
"Lord have mercy on their souls," Ace said.
"They didn't stand a chance," Rico said.
"I hope their sacrifice was worth it," Mendez said.
"It depends on us now," Fitz replied. "I just hope the other outposts and bases fare better than this one did."
Chapter 10 Fisher never got the opportunity to share a drink with Tran and Chase in Galveston. Instead, they were already on their way to work to Outpost El Paso in a C-23 Sherpa with Sergeant Sharp and a few of Cornelius's soldiers. The propellers buzzed as they began their descent. Coming in at the dead of night, Fisher was thankful he had grabbed a couple hours of shut-eye on the flight. He had a feeling he was going to need it with this new mission. General Cornelius had given him no easy task. Moonlight illuminated the craggy Texas landscape, nearly silhouetting the Franklin Mountains overlooking the Briggs Army airfield within the outpost.
"Almost there," Sharp said.
He rotated for a better view, his new blue armband showing. Fisher valued loyalty. Chase and Tran had proven their fealty to him time and time again. Usually he would be skeptical of a man like Sharp, who so quickly abandoned his post to join another's army. But as the Sherpa's wheels touched down on the runway, he couldn't blame the sergeant for joining up with Cornelius. The retired general knew how to get things done, and might be one of the best hopes the Allied States had of surviving the variants. The plane's prop engines wound down, and it taxied to a stop. As soon as the side door opened, the chilling night air flooded the plane's interior. Fisher stood, following Sharp and the soldiers out. A large man in military fatigues waited on the tarmac.
"Welcome to El Paso," he said in a gravelly voice.
The soldier offered a hand to Fisher as he spoke with a strong Northwest Texas drawl that might have been shared by one of Fisher's neighbors.
"Pleased to have y'all here. I'm Lieutenant Riggs, in charge of organizing defensive operations. Born and bred right here in El Paso."
"Good to meet a fellow local," Fisher said.
"I know the city and the land around it like the back of my hand. Still, I can't tell you how glad we are to have your boys working with us."
"Honored to help with the war efforts," Fisher said. "Anything I can do to kill some variants is all right by me. Have my men already set up the prospecting equipment?"
"Yes, sir. Follow me."
Riggs motioned to a pair of Humvees idling near the airstrip. The two-vehicle convoy took off, racing away from the airfield. They passed through darkened city streets, their headlights illuminated craters in the ground. Those craters looked like variant tunnels that had recently been filled in. Scree piled up next to the broken adobe houses, and bullet-hole-pocked cars lined many of the streets.
"We took a beating last night," Riggs said without turning.
"We did too," Fisher said. "Lost a lot of good men myself.
Cornelius warned me he didn't have enough to adequately outfit these trucks, but he promised you'd make do. Seems like your men have done just that."
Spotlights from guard towers probed the darkness. Banks of floodlights hooked up to rumbling diesel generators provided a wall of light over the huge concrete ramparts topped with razor wire looping around the outpost.
"We're headed straight into variant country at the foot of the mountains," Riggs said.
"With all these tunnels, seems to me like everything's become variant country now," Fisher said.
"If this works tonight, we can start reclaiming what's rightfully ours."
Riggs held up his radio.
"Bravo 1, Echo 1, actual. We're approaching the gate now."
The radio crackled with a reply.
"Copy, Echo 1. You're clear to proceed. Good luck out there."
A huge steel gate rolled back with the assistance of a growling motor. Heavily armed guards stood outside the entrance.
"Lost about a quarter of our men last night," Riggs said.
"But no contacts yet tonight?" Tran asked.
"Not out here," Riggs replied. "As late as 1800, we were still dealing with a few stragglers that hadn't retreated. They were mostly hanging around the mountains."
"How are the other outposts faring?" Chase asked.
"We're receiving reports the variants have launched attacks," Riggs said. "Size and scope vary, but safe to say, if that's any indication, we've got to be ready for anything. This will be the ultimate testing ground for the equipment."
"From the sounds of it, we don't have time for testing, and we need to get this tech deployed around the outposts ASAP," Chase said.
"Ain't that the truth?"
Riggs rubbed the stubble on his cheek.
"Gotta prove it works, though, and to do that, we got to go where the beasts are."
"Trial by fire," Fisher said.
A rooster tail of dirt kicked up from the first vehicle as it tore over the dusty terrain between the walls. The Humvee bucked as they rumbled off-road, and the headlights captured dried tumbleweeds and prickly cacti. Farther ahead, a series of mobile light posts had been set up. Beside them was a truck that looked like a militarized RV with long arrays of netted cables stretching across the ground.
"Ah, the geophone truck," Fisher said.
While most of the netted cables stretched into the darkness, he knew sensors were scattered along them, capable of picking up vibrating seismic waves coursing through the ground. Five men were already stationed around the vehicle with weapons, patrolling the rock-strewn landscape. A machine gunner lay prone atop the truck. The two Humvees filed in next to the mobile unit. Fisher opened the door to let himself out. Tran and Chase trailed him into the rocky landscape with Riggs.
"We've also got scouts posted with NVGs and thermal binos around each of the trucks," Riggs said.
He gestured to another three trucks scattered in the distance, each with their own set of floodlights. They appeared to be a cross between a lunar buggy and a Soviet-style Katyusha multiple rocket launcher truck. Those were the Vibra-sized trucks, each equipped with a large piston-driven shaker capable of generating seismic waves.
"You think one squad per truck is going to be enough to protect them when those monsters attack?" Fisher asked.
"It'll have to be," Riggs said. "We can't divert more manpower from base, given the reports of attacks elsewhere."
"Seems pretty risky for valuable equipment like this," Chase said, eyes narrowed. "Especially if you're expecting an attack."
"Worst case, we call in air support and hightail it out," Riggs said. "I'd rather lose equipment than men. It's not ideal, but it's what we've got to work with."
"And let's not waste any time huffing about it," Fisher said.
He set off for the geophone truck, spotting familiar faces working at the instruments inside the back cabin. He raised a hand in greeting, and they waved back. Green screens glowed in front of each. Soon those monitors would come to life when the thumper trucks activated, generating vibrations deep into the ground. Depending on how those seismic waves bounced toward the geophone truck's sensors, the engineers could identify the density of rock and earth beneath their feet, That meant it could also detect the hollow cavities where there was no rock. Exactly the kind of signal they expected from tunnels dug by the variants.
If we can prove this system works, then we can save a lot of lives by tracking variant tunnels before they burrow under our walls, Riggs said.
And when we detect burrowing variants, I'm assuming you have the means to deal with them? Fisher asked.
Riggs cracked a cocky grin.
We've had the past few decades to perfect bunker-busting bombs. You sure as hell bet that if we find the monsters underground, we can blow them sky high.
That's what I like to hear, Tran said.
Fisher grabbed a metal bar on the back of the geophone truck and hoisted himself into the open back door. He slid in beside the two engineers, and Riggs climbed in with him. Sharp, Tran, Chase, and the others formed a perimeter around the vehicle to reinforce the meager security forces.
Good to see you all made it out here safely, Fisher said to the engineers.
Likewise. We're glad to have you with us, sir,
the nearest engineer said, a portly man in his early 50s with a crown of graying hair.
Everything is ready to go when you are.
Time's already ticking by, so tell the thumpers to start pounding ground.
Yes, sir, the engineer said.
He relayed Fisher's commands to the other trucks, and the burble of their engines echoed over the bleak landscape. Each time the thumpers slammed against the ground, Fisher could feel the tremor pass up through the geophone truck and into his bones.
Strange sensation, Riggs said. I feel like a T-Rex is running at us.
The thumping continued as if the trucks were playing the earth like a bass drum. Fisher looked at the engineer's shoulders, watching the resulting signals passing to the geophone truck.
What can you see?
Riggs asked, squinting at the screens.
Sure ain't any oil down here, Fisher said. No natural gas deposits, if I'm reading it right.
Yes, sir, the graying engineer said. Nothing so far. No aberrations to indicate tunnels. Better not be, Riggs said. We collapsed the ones we found earlier. Took more effort than I'd like to admit, since we relied solely on the holes the Alphas left behind. If variants are coming back to attack El Paso tonight, they'll still have to pass back this way.
Your men did a damn fine job, then.
Fisher stopped, spotting something on the screen. Lines bounced around, indicating various depths and densities of the ground. One of those lines had suddenly dropped. That meant there was a void there. A sure sign of a natural gas deposit if it had been hundreds of feet deeper. But at only a few feet beneath the Earth's surface, he knew better.
Is that one of them? Fisher asked.
It's an anomaly, certainly, the engineer said. But there are also a few small caverns around these parts. Nothing unusual.
The thumper trucks continued sending seismic waves coursing through the earth. Fisher blinked at the lines zigzagging across the engineers' screens. The shapes became mesmerizing, almost hypnotic, as the engineers surveyed the land. He thought he heard a howl break through the night air, but the diesel engines and thumping from the machines made it difficult to tell whether it was real or not. He looked around at the others. Their attention remained on the screens. Maybe his mind was playing tricks on him. His exhaustion was getting the better of him, like it did in the tunnels back under his fields. He could still hear his wife's voice now, warning him danger was at hand.
"Keep an eye on that so-called cavern," Fisher said.
Their efforts continued for another 30 minutes as they identified potential sites to investigate, but nothing that leapt out as variant activity. Then, the first engineer leaned back, mouth open, his fingers frozen at his keyboard.
Sir, the anomaly. It's growing, and it's headed straight toward us.
Riggs started barking orders into his radio, telling his men to be on alert.
We've detected the formation of what looks like 5 tunnels in total. The variants must be burrowing as we speak.
Fisher turned to Riggs.
We got the tunnel locations you wanted. Now how about sending them all to a fiery hell like you promised?
You give me the coordinates, I'll send the bombs, Riggs said.
We're tracking them now, the engineer said. Riggs called all the coordinates as the engineer relayed them. The tunnels crawled forward, drawing ever closer to the trucks and outpost El Paso. Fisher couldn't help but wonder if this was happening across the country.
Where's that fire support? He snapped.
Riggs twisted his wrist and looked at his watch.
30 seconds.
though seconds passed by agonizingly slowly. Fisher waited for the ground to open before them, alphas pushing out, followed by a horde of wart-covered variants clawing for fresh meat. A voice sprang in his mind.
Leave. Now. Go.
It was his wife's voice again, more adamant now. He had failed to heed her warning back in the tunnels under Fisher Fields, and it had nearly gotten everyone on his team killed.
You can't stay here.
The tunnels grew slowly. Fisher's heart thundered. To him, watching the screens was like witnessing the mushroom cloud of a distant atomic bomb, seeing the devastation that would soon overcome them. But he was unable to do anything to stop it except to pray.
Leave.
He considered telling his men to stop, to retreat, but he held steady. Another few seconds passed, and a sonic boom tore overhead. Fisher nearly jumped at the roar. Somewhere above them, like dragons in the night, the fighter jets tore through the sky. A flash of light exploded over the horizon. Another four followed in quick succession, more blinding than any of the floodlights around the trucks. The ground rumbled violently. The relentless sound blasted over the truck, assaulting Fisher's eardrums. He stood tall, watching the screens. The vibrations from the bunker buster bombs sent a crash of signals through the ground and into the geophone truck, throwing off their tunnel detection abilities. Fisher waited for the signals to settle. The engineers stared at the monitor, neither of them blinking. 10 seconds passed before the seismic waves from the bombs dissipated, leaving only the heavy smack of the thumper trucks to shake the ground. On the screen, the 5 tunnels appeared again. But this time they were much larger. Fisher stroked his mustache nervously, anticipating movement from those new caverns in the ground. But the earth beneath them remained lifeless.
"Sir, I think we're clear," said one of the engineers in a surprised voice, as if he didn't believe it himself. "No indication of anomalies. No expansion of the original tunnels."
"I presume them variants are all crispy critters now," Fisher said.
"You're sure?" Riggs said.
Fisher leaned over the engineer's shoulder to study the screen.
"Dead as doornails, Lieutenant."
"Holy shit," Riggs said, looking away from the screen.
"Sir, I have a feeling you and your men are going to find yourselves very busy for the next few weeks. If this technology works this good all the time, it could very well be the thing we need to win this war."
"Maybe," Fisher said. "I sure hope you got a big supply of those bunker busters, because we going to need a hell of a lot of them."
"Our F-35s have eliminated the targets outside of Outpost Portland," reported General Sousa.
Victorious cheers and applause filled the briefing room. President Ringgold wanted to share in the celebration with her staff and the officers, but the leaden weight of dread held her back. For every victory, they had 10 more setbacks, and she still hadn't heard anything new about Beckham and Horn since their disappearance. Not to mention the reports of new variant attacks at other outposts. The news kept hitting like a relentless hailstorm. Scott AFB was already gone, wiped off the map just hours earlier. Her eyes darted back to the wall-mounted monitor, where a digital map of the Allied States displayed the now remaining 83 outposts. The 6 main target cities of Minneapolis, Chicago, Lincoln, Kansas City, Indianapolis, and Columbus were again under full-scale attack. But at least Team Ghost had escaped Scott's collapse. By now, they would be closing in on their new target to find another mastermind. She had to keep reminding herself that while the variants were on the offensive, so were the brave men and women of the military. Tonight, she felt a desire to be out there fighting alongside those who placed themselves in harm's way. Sometimes it's better to craft a strong strategy for the troops on the ground rather than standing there with them and pulling a trigger. A good leader knows the difference, Beckham had told her during the first war. Remembering those words helped assuage the guilt she felt. After all, she had a plan. She had a way that humanity would survive this mess. The science team just needed to tap into the network of the masterminds. If Kate and Carr achieved that, and if the tunnel detecting equipment worked for Fisher and his men, then they had a chance of stopping this madness before it consumed the Allied States, especially if General Cornelius pulled through on his somewhat mysterious promise of potentially having access to even more powerful technology to bolster their defenses.
Madam President, I just got a report that the final defenses of Outpost Kansas City have fallen, announced General Souza. We've got live footage from one of our teams in the air.
The words made Ringgold's stomach knot. Lieutenant Festa turned on a wall-mounted monitor. The view came on screen with an image of the interstate. Hundreds of headlights from evacuating vehicles glimmered on the road. The footage turned dark as the pilots circled for a better vantage point. They had established this outpost years ago, after the military cleaned up the area. Its strategic location on the Missouri River made transportation of resources easier. The vast network of sheltered limestone caverns also proved useful for storage for so many local businesses. By almost all measures, it was the biggest outpost in the Allied States with multiple districts, including clearly demarcated residential, business, and industrial zones. The river and roadways provided multiple convenient routes to transport resources.
Please tell me we got everyone into the caves, Ringgold said.
Most of them. And the outpost commander has dedicated a good chunk of forces to protect the caves, Festa said. We'll evacuate more of them tomorrow when daylight drives the beasts back.
Tomorrow, Ringgold whispered. For much of the country, there wouldn't be a tomorrow.
Who has a sit rep on the other outposts? I want to know if we have identified or captured collaborators, she said.
Festa held up a marked-up map. He was helping oversee the prioritizing of outpost defenses and evacuations.
The few that have been captured have committed suicide, and we haven't identified any new cells, he said. But we're working hard on this, Madam President, I assure you.
Redouble your efforts on that front, Ringgold said, holding back a sigh. Now how about the physical threat of an attack?
As you know, we're moving more of the survivors east as the outposts around the western target cities are overrun, he said. While the current attacks are mostly centered around these six targets, there are smaller variant hordes that seem to be working alongside collaborators to hit places like Outpost Portland, Outpost Boston, etc.
The safest place is to move these people are locations with geographical or geological attributes that make it difficult for variants to tunnel under, Lemke said. The Vice President noted outposts including Norfolk, Kent Island, and Manchester.
We are going to start evacuating more people to these areas and concentrating our defenses there as a last resort, he said.
The aerial footage came back online. This time, the helicopter was flying over the outer defenses along the banks of the river. The fences and walls had collapsed, and the minefields were nothing but smoking craters. Dark holes with halos of fresh dirt and rock marred the inside of the outpost where variants had burst through the ground. The chopper turned back to the interstate. Muzzle flashes sparked from people abandoning their vehicles and trying to hold back the hordes of beasts. Cortez put her hand over her mouth. Armored juveniles raced down the road, chasing helpless people fleeing the devastation. Suddenly, a section of the intersection burst with a bright glow of explosions. Fighter jets had dropped their payloads to buy the survivors time. For those already captured by the juveniles, it was a swift and merciful end to their suffering. Another round of bombs burst across the interstate, and then the chopper turned away from the view. As the hours passed, the other six outposts around the target cities crumbled, their defenses failing, and the variants spreading like a virus. The irony wasn't lost on her. Festa and other officers worked to keep the map updated, but by 2 in the morning, almost every outpost in the Allied States was under some degree of attack. A surprise call came just when Ringgold felt her brain boiling with frustration and fear. Soprano handed her a satellite phone.
Ringgold here, she said.
Madam President, it's General Cornelius. I have an update on our work in El Paso.
I could use some good news. What's going on, General?
It is good, ma'am. The technology works. Fisher and his men were able to not only detect tunnels, but we also used that data to destroy them before the monsters could even surface.
You have no idea how glad I am to hear this. How soon before we can start deploying these measures?
I'm going to need help getting this equipment to the outposts where it's needed most. I think we can also locate better technology to augment these defenses from some old Department of Defense laboratories in California.
Whatever you need.
Time is what I need most, and I'm afraid we don't have that.
The general paused and then said,
I've got 500 of my troops ready to deploy where you see fit. What I don't have is the aircraft to make all this happen.
I think we can handle that, she said. Let me speak to my team.
I'll call you later when we've decided on our course of action.
Okay, thank you, Madam President.
Talk soon, Ringgold said. She set the phone down and described the request to everyone in the room.
I won't be able to identify the outposts where we need those troops the most until sunrise, Festa said.
Not until we know which ones are left, Ringgold said, realization hitting her like a brick.
If this strategy works as well as General Cornelius claims, then we need to make that a priority mission, Lemke said.
That will require rearranging our resources and aircraft, Sousa interjected, which means pulling some off evacuations.
Being president for almost 8 years had taught her she often had to choose the greater good over individuals. But in this case, they were talking about leaving thousands of people stranded in order to save tens of thousands.
If we don't get that equipment where we need it, then all we're doing is prolonging the inevitable by evacuating people, Lemke said. I'm afraid we have no choice but to resource aircraft for this new mission.
Ringgold knew the guilt would crush her later, but for now, there was no other choice in her mind. Lemke gave her a hard nod of approval. Authorized, she said. The room broke into a bustle of activity as the staff and officers erupted in conversation. Ringgold sat watching in silence, considering the implications of her orders.
Ma'am, came a voice.
Cortez bent down next to Ringgold.
We just got word that Captain Beckham and Master Sergeant Horn have made it back to Outpost Portland safely.
Thank God, Ringgold said. She welcomed the additional good news.
Lieutenant Niven said they took on an entire horde of variants, Cortez said. That's how the Iron Hogs knew where to call in the air support.
Ringgold twisted to look back at the younger woman.
Guess those two aren't so retired anymore, Cortez said, flashing a smile.
Ringgold smiled back and then got out of her chair. She walked over to the hatch, a voice calling out after her when she reached it.
Madam President, where are you going? Soprano asked.
To see Dr. Lovato to let her know her husband is safe? At the way things are turning out, hopefully she'll have some good news for us. All the science in the world won't save us if there are more collaborators out there ready to unleash hell, Lemke said.
The Vice President was right, and Ringgold knew it. At this point, she wasn't sure there was anything that could save the Allied States, but she would rather die than hand it over to the monsters. Chapter 11. The thuds from the not-so-distant explosions had passed over an hour ago, maybe longer, but the group of collaborators were still fuming across the chamber from Timothy. They stood near piles of collapsed ceiling. Several of the pieces had landed on human prisoners, tearing them from the wall and crushing them to pulp on the concrete floor. It was a mercy, Timothy thought.
He's gonna be furious, said the short man in his Brooklyn accent. We gotta blame someone for this. Pete seems like the logical choice. You boys gotta back that up, okay?
He paced in front of the passage that the men had entered through. The other two collaborators, one with a Red Sox hat and the other wearing a stocking cap, both sat on crates. A radio crackled across the space, but Timothy couldn't make out the transmission. He strained to listen, but he was still groggy. He had passed out earlier and had been jolted awake by those explosions. All he heard was the response from the short collaborator.
Oh, man. This is so fucked up, he said. Everything has gone to shit, and someone is going to have to answer for this. One of us. One of us is going to be fed to them.
The other two men got off their crates and paced nervously. From what Timothy had gathered so far, a group of their soldiers had engaged a truck back on the same road he was kidnapped. But those collaborators had never returned. Someone had killed them, and apparently taken off with explosives meant to be used on the outpost. Not only that, but the variant hordes they had deployed to attack Outpost Portland had been destroyed. Probably by whatever had caused those explosions Timothy had heard. Someone had severely messed up the collaborators' battle plan, and Timothy couldn't be happier. He held back a grin. In the past, he might have thought something like this was Beckham and Horn's doing, but they had abandoned him, Bo, Donna, and everyone else they had sworn to protect. Someone else, someone with real balls, was responsible for the badass attack that had killed those raiders and resulted in the utter demolition of the variant horde.
Another man suddenly walked into the chamber wearing camouflage and a black ski mask. He stripped the mask off, and long dreadlocked hair fell over his shoulders. The other three collaborators all took a step backward. This must be the real leader, Timothy thought. The man they all feared.
The attack on the outpost failed, said the new man, almost calmly. We lost one wave of beasts and two demo crews. I've called back the other teams, and the rest of the beasts are safe for now.
He looked away from his soldiers to scan the crushed prisoners.
What a fucking disaster, he said.
Anger rose in his voice and his next words.
The Master's wrath is going to come down hard.
Master will want a head, the short man said in his Brooklyn accent.
It'll be one of us, won't it?
Don't be such a pussy, Vin, said the man with dreadlocks.
The only way our heads don't end up on spikes is if we show strength.
I'm no pussy, Pete, said Vin.
You're sure acting like one, Pete said.
He flipped his dreadlocks over his back and looked at the other two collaborators.
With tonight's fuck-up, we gotta show we still have plenty of meat to draw from at the outpost.
Vin looked across the room, and Pete followed his gaze to Timothy. The dreadlocked man took a step forward. Timothy squirmed in the restraints, sensing whatever happened next wasn't going to be good.
Check the orders, Pete instructed.
The four collaborators fanned out across the space, but Pete stopped a few feet in front of Timothy.
He's a real wiggler, Vin said. Like a worm.
Only one to survive the variants in the forest, said Red Sox Hat.
So, he's a fighter, said Pete.
He leaned forward. Once again, Timothy was being studied and scrutinized by a monster in the chamber. Judging by the way the collaborators kept their distance from Pete, even they were scared of him. This guy was not someone Timothy would want to be in a room alone with. He exuded confidence and terror. Maybe he was the one that had led the attack on Peaks Island. Maybe he killed my father. Rage warmed his chest. A spike of adrenaline helped him fight harder against the glue holding him in place.
Yeah, he's a fighter, Pete said.
That's right. And I'll kill that wannabe gangster over there if you let me go, Timothy said.
For a moment, Pete simply glared at Timothy, but then his face twisted into a grim smirk.
You got balls, kid.
Not a kid, Timothy said.
He directed his eyes at Vin.
And that guy is a real fucking coward if you ask me.
He raised his voice and added,
You should have heard what he said before you got here.
What the fuck? Vin yelled, his voice echoing. He ran over, clearly caught off guard. Before he could get to Timothy, Pete stuck out his arm to hold Vin back.
He's lying, Pete, Vin said.
He spat on Timothy.
He's just a lying little rat.
Pete pressed his arm harder against Vin's chest.
Get back, Pete growled. I want to hear what he has to say.
He was going to throw you under the bus for whatever is happening out there, Timothy said.
That's a fucking lie, Vin protested in a nasally voice.
Timothy would have shrugged if he could have.
Just ask the other two guys if you don't believe me.
Pete looked over at Red Sox and Stocking Cap.
Well, boys, kid telling a truth?
Neither made a move.
I find out you are lying to me, too. All three of you are being fed to our fanged friends, so again, the kid telling a truth.
They both nodded, nearly cowering as they did. Vin looked at them both, and then turned back to Pete, who had drawn a knife. Before he could so much as mutter a word of protest, Pete sliced Vin's neck from ear to ear. Blood gushed from the wound. Vin reached up to stop the flow, mouth opening like a fish on land, and dropped to his knees, eyes pinned on Timothy. Timothy smirked at the dying collaborator, hoping he suffered as he crumpled to the floor. Blood spread around him like a broken shadow as he writhed. Pete leaned in close to Timothy.
So, you are part of the militia at Portland, he asked.
A nod.
You were part of it, Pete corrected. You're the type of dumb kid thinks he's invincible, aren't you?
Timothy didn't reply.
That's why the military has always had an age limit and recruits from high schools.
I know.
I was one of them kids. Pete snorted. Somehow you got lucky to survive this far. Oh, maybe not. Maybe you can fight and know how to stay alive.
Timothy raised his chin slightly. He didn't want this guy's compliments. He wanted to kill the fucker. But if sucking up gave him an opportunity to do just that, he'd take it.
I respect that. But I don't like rats, Pete said. Still, some rats are bigger than others. Especially the kind that try to stab you in the back.
He again looked at Vin. The man was twitching, his face bleach white as the final seconds of life faded away.
Guess our team has a new opening.
Pete returned his gaze to Timothy.
You might be lucky enough to join our army if you play your cards right.
The guy with the Red Sox hat took it off.
The most powerful in all of history. The army that the military only dreamed of when they created VX-99. An army of super soldiers and genetically superior beings, said Pete. Come over here, Alfred.
The man with the stocking cap joined Pete. He took it off, exposing a balding head with long, thin hair. He pushed the cap to his chest and reached out with his other hand to Timothy's forehead like a priest might during a blessing.
You've been saved to help with the Great Reckoning, Alfred said in an almost soothing voice. To help fight for the land of the new gods.
He let his hand fall away from Timothy's forehead, but held his gaze for several long beats before stepping away.
Get him down from there, Whiskey, Pete said.
The man with the Red Sox hat put it back on and moved over with the knife. He used the blade to start cutting Timothy out of the glue prison.
My name's Nick, he said. They call me Whiskey sometimes.
The man's breath sure smelled like his nickname. When Timothy was free, his numb body fell forward. He crashed to the ground in front of Vin's corpse, the man's dead eyes staring up at him. In time, Timothy knew all the collaborators would be doing the exact same thing. This was his chance to get in his enemy's head. He would have his revenge, and he would become the soldier his father would be proud of. The men surrounded him and dragged him up to his feet. He staggered, but kept his balance as his vision cleared. Nick pulled out a water bottle and handed it over. Timothy didn't want their charity, but he needed it to survive. He snatched the bottle and gulped it down until he choked. When he finished coughing, he took another sip, this time slower.
Easy, kid, Nick mumbled in a deep voice.
Wiping droplets off his chin, Timothy handed the bottle back.
Let's go, Pete said.
The dreadlocked man led them from the chamber. Timothy stumbled several times, his muscles weak from the neglect and his legs numb, but he managed to keep going. As he passed the crushed and mangled prisoners, he kept his eyes forward. The circular room emptied into a long passageway. Candle wax bled from sconces along the concrete walls and pooled on the floor. Pete led the way, with Alfred and Nick following Timothy. They passed multiple steel doors, all of them rusty. Several were open, and Timothy glimpsed living quarters, pantries, and supply rooms. Finally, they came to the entrance of another chamber, sealed off with mesh wire. Pete flipped on a flashlight. The beam penetrated the inky black beyond the wiring and hit a concrete wall covered in dark stains.
Come here, Pete said, jerking his chin.
Timothy stepped up to look into the chamber. This one was deeper, like a silo that plunged so far into the earth he couldn't see the bottom, even with the light angled downward. Pete pulled out a remote that looked like the one the men had used to control the variant that had nearly eaten Timothy's face. A rustling sounded, followed by what sounded like gusting wind. A shiver coursed through Timothy's flesh. He wanted to back away, but a hand on his back kept him in front of the mesh wire. Pete clicked a button on the remote. A shriek exploded up the silo, echoing loudly. It faded away, replaced by the rustling that quickly grew to a strong din like a tornado rising up through the chamber. Timothy couldn't remember ever hearing anything like it. All at once, hundreds of birds surged upward, flocking around the exterior of the mesh, some of them flapping into the wire. Timothy flinched, but the collaborator's hand kept him where he was. Pete tilted the flashlight to illuminate the creatures. The glow revealed these weren't birds. They were bats. Both Nick and Pete laughed, but Alfred remained silent.
This is your army? Timothy asked.
Not exactly, Pete said. He pushed Timothy against the wire.
Have a good look, kid, he said.
Bats screeched in his face, their wings beating the air.
Cross me, and I promise I won't slit your neck like Vin, Pete said.
Pete moved his hand from Timothy's back. Timothy staggered back a few feet to put distance between him and the wire, watching the colony of twisted creatures rattling the mesh wall.
Ever seen hundreds of starving bats infected with VX-99 swarm a human? Nick asked.
Timothy shook his head.
Cross me, and you'll find yourself on the other side of this wire, kid, Pete said.
He turned away and nodded at Nick.
Get our rabid little friends ready, Whiskey. It's time for round two, Pete said.
Beckham and Horn sat in lawn chairs outside of Corthell Hall at the University of Southern Maine. At 4 in the morning, they were both exhausted, but Beckham couldn't manage a wink of sleep. His head pounded from his injury, making it all the more difficult. Knowing Timothy was still out there, or more likely dead, dragged heavily on his mind. He had failed in his promise to Jake that he would look after his son. He had failed Timothy. Those thoughts haunted him. When he had made a call to the USS George Johnson, he was almost glad that Kate had been in the middle of an experiment. As much as he wanted to talk to her, he didn't want to admit he had let Timothy down. Instead, he just made sure that someone would tell her that he and Horn were okay.
His sacrifice helped protect the city, at least, Horn had said earlier. If it weren't for us going after him, those variants might have made it to the outpost.
Horn was right, but that didn't make Beckham feel better. He massaged the knot on his scalp and looked at the tents spread out across the campus lawn. Somewhere in one of those tents, Bo and Donna were sleeping. While Beckham couldn't see them, there were snipers on every rooftop watching over these people like angels in the night. Angels with M107A150 caliber rifles and a few M72 Law rockets. Snoring that sounded like chainsaws chewing wood distracted him from his thoughts, ensuring he wasn't going to sleep anytime soon. He glanced over at Horn. The big man had finally managed to drift off. It wasn't surprising. Big Horn could sleep through a firefight. Beckham closed his eyes, hoping for some sleep too, but it simply wouldn't come. Besides the snoring, he was too worried about things outside of his control, including Kate. He worried about what he would say to her when he returned, and what their next steps would be. He got up from his chair, deciding to head back up to the rooftop of Corthell Hall. That's where he would find Ruckley. When he got there, she was standing near the edge of the roof with a pair of FLIR BN-10 thermal binoculars scanning the city. One of the snipers glanced back at him as he approached, but then turned back to his scope.
"How's it look out there?" Beckham asked.
He approached Ruckley as she lowered the binos. "So far no sign of another attack," she replied. "We're lucky. Sounds like outposts are still being hit hard." Another voice came behind Beckham.
"You trying to sneak away from me, boss?"
Horn grumbled, rubbing sleep from his eyes.
"Sorry, didn't want to wake you," Beckham said.
Horn shrugged and walked over to the edge with him.
"At least it's quiet now," Beckham said.
"I'd say we got lucky for tonight being quiet," Ruckley said. "But luck has nothing to do with it. That was all thanks to you two."
"Wish Lieutenant Niven would have sent scouts out to look for the collaborators after those airstrikes," Beckham said. "Now is the perfect time to hunt those assholes and look for their rat nests."
Ruckley frowned. "Look, I want to find the collaborators as much as you guys do, but we're on defense right now. We simply don't have enough people to risk missions without better intel." She was right, and while Beckham knew that, he also remembered the risks they took during the first war against the variants. Some were stupid, but others paid off. Tonight was stupid and had paid off. Ruckley sighed.
"Glad you guys came up here because I got some news.
Good, I hope,
Horn said. Afraid not, Ruckley replied. Beckham braced himself. Scott AFB fell a few hours ago, she said. The variants hit them hard and fast, overwhelming the command building in less than an hour.
What about Team Ghost? Beckham stammered.
They made it out. They were launching a new mission when the attack came. Hearing Fitz and the remaining team members were alive was a relief, but finding out they were being tossed into the fray again was another gut punch.
Where?
Horn asked. Ruckley shrugged. Not sure. It's classified. Horn cursed and muttered under his breath. I'm sorry, Ruckley said. With everything going on tonight, the chances of Team Ghost surviving this new war weren't good. Then again, the chances of the Allied States surviving weren't good either. I hope wherever they're going will help put an end to all of this, Ruckley said. Someone far above my pay grade better have a plan, because sitting here waiting for the bastards to attack again feels like we're waiting for a bomb to drop on us. Beckham knew all too well that part of the plan would include Team Ghost, but he didn't reply. So what's your plan? Ruckley said. I sure hope it doesn't include pulling any more stunts like tonight.
No more stunts, Beckham agreed. I think we'll get Bo and Donna back to command tomorrow, and then figure out how we can help with the war effort. What are our orders?
Horn asked Ruckley. She looked out over the city. For now, the Iron Hogs are digging in and holding this outpost. Portland has been designated one of the safer zones. We're supposed to get refugees from places that were hit harder than us, like Kansas City, maybe Houston. The sniper Beckham had noticed earlier got up and walked over. Sorry to interrupt, Sergeant, he said in a timid voice. But I overheard you say something about Kansas City. My sister is there. Do you know how they're holding out? The sniper was young, probably only 19 or 20, with a baby face and scared blue eyes. He reminded Beckham of Alex Riley. Things aren't good, Johnson, Ruckley replied. I'm sorry, but last I heard, their defenses had fallen, and people were being evacuated into the nearby caverns for shelter. Johnson's eyes dropped in despair.
We've been written off a lot of times, brother, Horn said. And we've made it back each time. You just gotta have a little faith, Beckham added.
Damn straight, Ruckley said. Hell, I thought you were both dead tonight, and you ended up taking on a horde of variants 100 strong. Alone. Johnson let out a light huff. Yeah, but you guys are legends.
Nah, we're just normal guys that don't give up when shit hits the fan, Horn said. Try not to worry too much, and focus on taking each day one at a time.
Thanks, Johnson said. He returned to his post, not looking convinced. An eerie quiet hung over them for a few minutes. If Beckham closed his eyes and forgot about the past several hours, he could almost be at peace, listening to the chirp of a few nocturnal animals and feeling the gentle caress of the breeze. But even if he tried to forget it all, the world seemed intent on reminding him this was no time for letting down his guard. The handset radio crackled on Ruckley's vest. Ironhog 2, go ahead, over, she said. Ironhog 2, Raptor Eye 3, we're picking up movement on the north edge of... A blinding explosion suddenly erupted in the distance. It had come from Peaks Island. The Raptor recon team was camped out there to watch for collaborators, and something had just blown them to pieces. Horn readied his rifle. Raptor Eye 3, do you copy? Ruckley said. She tried again and again, receiving only static. Another flash lit up the island. One by one, blasts rocked the terrain, geysers of smoke and fire gushing up from the impacts.
Is that artillery? Horn said.
A siren wailed, and people emerged from the tents, dazed and groggy. Soldiers ran out to escort them into the buildings, but chaos quickly broke out, people tripping and falling in the darkness. Frightened screams carried through the makeshift campgrounds as people stampeded for shelter. What the hell is that? Johnson said. The sniper lowered his rifle from the skyline and pointed. Ruckley brought up her thermal binos. Looks like birds, she said. The blasts must have scared them.
Let me see, Beckham said.
Ruckley handed him the binos. He used his good eye to focus on the red dots flocking across the view. There were hundreds of the creatures, a dark, undulating cloud traversing over the horizon. but they weren't scattering like Beckham would have expected a flock of frightened birds to do. They were heading right for the campus. He lowered the binos to look at the fires now dancing across Peaks Island. These weren't just birds. When strange things like this happened, Beckham didn't believe in coincidences. Something about those birds hurtling toward them set his nerves on fire.
"We have to get everyone inside now," he yelled.
Then he pointed to the unmanned spotlight on the rooftop next to Johnson.
"Get the light on those birds," he commanded.
Johnson did as ordered. Ruckley brought her radio to her lips.
"Turn all spotlights to the sky. Target those birds."
The spotlights on the other roofs turned skyward to the formation of black. The creatures didn't soar, but zigzagged and swooped through the sky, their wings moving in a blur.
"Holy shit," Horn said, drawing out the syllables. "Those aren't birds. They're bats, and they're coming straight at us."
"Shoot them,"
Beckham yelled. He didn't know why the little flying mammals would be coming at them, but he knew it wasn't for anything good. He raised his rifle and flicked off the safety. Muzzle flashes came from the other rooftops as the order passed over the comm channels. The bats dipped lower, some diving and flapping through the rounds. They were nearly impossible to hit, flickering through the gunfire. An explosion rocked the first building across the campus, sending soldiers cartwheeling away from the roof. Beckham changed his magazine and watched in horror as the creatures dove for the tents and the fleeing innocents. Something detonated, spitting up fire so bright he had to shield his eyes from the glow. Even from the rooftop he could feel the heat. More bats crashed into the ground and surrounding buildings, blowing up upon impact. Beckham might have brought down a couple, but he could quickly see they weren't going to stop this destructive force of suicidal creatures. A formation broke off and flew toward their location.
"Run!"
Ruckley shouted. The team retreated back inside the building as blasts shook the rooftop. Retreating soldiers tumbled from the concussive force, falling against the stairs. Heavy booms rattled the structure, and ceiling panels collapsed, breaking over the floor. Beckham tripped on a landing and fell, only to be yanked up by Horn. When they got to the bottom of Corthell Hall, the thunderstorm of explosions ceased, replaced by the agonized screams of the injured and dying. Beckham saw the surviving creatures peeling away, disappearing almost as fast as they had attacked. Civilians flooded through the doors. Some of them had devastating burns and bleeding shrapnel wounds. One man had lost an arm and staggered, eyes staring blankly ahead with shock. Another man's face was partially burned away, his ear and nose darkened into crisped flakes. Soldiers helped carry in the injured. The shouts and cries of horror filled the night. Beckham looked for Beau and Donna in the masses of panicked people wading through with Horn.